Sapphire's womb, they slid. Queen mothers and forefathers, these are the shoulders that have carried us here. These are the backbone to our giant tree. They speak like tongueless bells. Light marching from the bowels of time. Their voices piercing the denseness of history. Proverbs melt like warm music in our ears. They are the builders of civilization, and we are their children. Sculptors of pyramids, inventors of science. We are seeds rooted in the cosmos of African clay. We are spears thrown into the future. Crescendos over the dung hills of stale hyena's madness. We are temples and walking shrines. We are earth people and earth songs. Blacksmith dancers and village drummers. Sunburst and naked flowers. We drink palm wine and eat cassava and yam. Our lips drip with the mango nectar. We give praise that we may hear these voices, moving like a bamboo flute song in silence. Honest work is our worship. We place like a bed of gold before the infinite and those now gone from sight. In the wind we learn that the diehards do not die. They only echo throughout the universe.
Mr. President, members of Convocation, members of the University, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, when I was in prison, a young lady who is now the principal of a leading university in South Africa came to see me. She did not beat about the bush. She said, if my father were still alive, she would have been 70. You are 70. And I came here to see how a man of 70 looks like. Now I am 80. And I'm very encouraged to see so many people who have turned up. But I'm not so sure whether many of you have not come here to see how a man of 80 looks like. I keep on asking my wife and my colleagues who accompany me to this meeting that they must excuse me from telling the same story. But you will see how appropriate it is for me to repeat the story. That is when I found some place in my country. And the lady answered the telephone. I then asked, to whom am I speaking? She said, you're speaking to me. I said, well, lady, I know I'm speaking to you. But what's your name? She said, who are you to ask for my name? What's your name? I say, well, lady, as soon as you tell me your name, I'll tell you mine. But as we argued as to who should tell his or her name, she became very cross. And she said, you seem to be a backward person. Have you passed your matric? Now, matric in our country is a university entry examination. And I said, well, lady, you must be very careful. Because if the qualification to speak to you is the possession of a matric certificate, I might work hard and pass my matric and be in the same class as you are. That was treason. She said, you will never be in my class, and bang the telephone. How I wish she were here today. She would now discover that I have achieved more than past my matric. Ladies and gentlemen, this may very well be our last official visit to the United States before retiring from office next year. There could not be a more moving start to the visit than one which included being honored in this way by one of the great educational institutions of this nation and of the world. I know that through this award, you are not so much recognizing any individual achievement, but are rather paying tribute to the struggles and achievements of the South African people as a whole. I humbly accept the award in that spirit, while at the same time wishing you to know that we are not unaware of nor unmoved by the great compliment you pay us by conferring this degree at a specially convened convocation to join George Washington and Winston Churchill as the other recipients of such an award conferred at a specially convened convocation is not only a stage honor, it also holds a great symbolic significance to the mind and to the future memory of this great American and to the future memory, the name of an African is now added to those two illustrious leaders. before. That one of the striking features of modern times is the emergence of men and women, and indeed of institutions that have chosen the world as the theater of their operations, as the platform from which to ventilate their thinking and their ideas. Few people will deny that at the University of Harvard is one of those institutions that have chosen the entire world in order to bring strength and hope to those who otherwise would have had no future at all. And I wanted to congratulate this university for the sterling effort it has made in order to ensure that those who have been denied opportunities for decades can now serve. If in these later years of a life lived in pursuit of equality, we can at last look upon our own country as one in which citizens, regardless of race, gender or creed, share equal political rights and opportunities for development, we do so with great gratitude towards the millions upon millions all around the world who materially, thank you very much, who materially and morally supported our struggle for freedom and justice. Together with those freedom and justice loving citizens of the world, we do at the same time, however, note that is at the end of this century, a century which humanity entered with such high hopes for progress, the world is still beset by great disparities between the rich and the poor, both within countries and between different parts of the world. If in individual life we all may reach that part of the long walk where the opportunity is granted to retire to some rest and tranquility for humanity, the walk to freedom and equality seems, alas, still to be a long one ahead. This august institution gains its standing and reputation also from the manner in which it has conducted and continues to conduct itself as an international presence. Wherever men and women of learning and thought gather, its name and work are known. It embodies that spirit of universality which marks a great university. To join the ranks of the alumni is to be reminded of the oneness of our global world. The greatest single challenge facing our globalized world is to combat and eradicate its disparities. While in all parts of the world their progress is being made in entrenching democratic forms of government, we constantly need to remind ourselves that the freedoms which democracy brings will remain empty shells if they are not accompanied by real and tangible improvement in the material lives of the millions of ordinary citizens of those countries. Men and women and children go burdened with hunger, suffering from preventable diseases, languishing in ignorance and illiteracy, or finding themselves bereft of decent shelter, talk of democracy and freedom that does not recognize these material aspects can ring hollow and erode the confidence exactly in those values we seek to promote. Hence, our universal obligation towards the building of a world in which there shall be greater equality among nations and among citizens of nations. The disparity between the developed and developing world, between North and South, reflects itself also in the sphere of educational and intellectual resources. When in Africa we speak and dream of and work for a rebirth of that continent as a full participant in the affairs of the world in the next century, we are deeply conscious of how dependent that is on the mobilization and strengthening of the continent's resources of learning. The current world financial crisis also starkly reminds us that many of the concepts that guided our sense of how the world and its affairs are best ordered have suddenly been shown to be wanting. They are seen to have hidden real structural defects in the world's economic system. The precepts of the economic theorists, who could so confidently prescribe to all, now appear to have drawn much of their apparent intellectual validation from having been unchallenged by the day-to-day operation of a system that operated in the interest of the powerful and not the poorest of the poor. Not only does this crisis call for fundamental rethinking and reconceptualization on the part of the theorists of the North, it more particularly and urgently emphasizes the need for thinkers and intellectuals of the developing world to sharpen their skills and analysis and for a genuine partnership between those of the North and the South in helping shape a world order that answers to the shared and common need of all the people and not just the rich. This university already has had a long partnership of learning and teaching with the South African people. There are many names that one could mention of persons now holding office in government or institutions of civil society who spent a time at Harvard or benefited from programs conducted jointly with this institution. For that, our fledgling democracy, faced with the enormous task of reconstruction and development, owes your institution a great debt of gratitude. As South Africans play their role in helping to conceptualize and give content to the African Renaissance, we continue to draw upon the intellectual skills nurtured and honed here. The United States of America and democratic South Africa have, in the course of these last 4 years, built a relationship of mutual respect and cooperation. Each country, respecting the sovereignty of the other while cooperating as partners. As part of this relationship, the scholars who had the benefit of studying here returned better equipped to deal with the local challenges and problems as Africans. It is therefore a source of great encouragement and inspiration for us to learn about the emerging Africa's research program housed in the newly created Center for International Development at Harvard. Its objective of undertaking an appraisal of Africa's economic, social, and political history, as well as the problems facing the continent, is timely and to be greatly welcomed. But it will be doing this in collaboration with African research institutions and scholars, will serve to strengthen and build African intellectual capacity to take charge of its reconstruction and regeneration. I am confident that it will also strengthen and build your own understanding of African reality and your capacity to analyze that reality as part of our shared world. Mr. President, we accept this great honor bestowed upon us today as a symbol of how South Africa and the United States, Africa and the world, the developing and the developed world, are reaching out and joining hands as partners in building a world order that equally benefits all the nations and people of the world. For 300 years, this great institution has served this nation with distinction. We enter the new millennium in the hope that the rich fruits of learning, science, and technological progress will, in this coming century, truly be shared by all in this global village in which we live. We are confident that this institution, of which we are now a proud member, will play a leading role in achieving that. Well, I have given you a glimpse of what some South Africans think of the president. I think it would be unfair to close this address without getting a more vivid picture of what some South Africans think of this man. When I turned 75, a young lady was, it was reported that there was a young lady of about 5 at the gate of my house. And they say, she wants to see you. I said, look at her. The security said, Mr. President, she's very cheeky. I say, precisely for that reason, let her come in. She came in, and indeed, she was a great lady. She did not knock, she did not greet, she just said, how old are you? I said, well, I can't remember. But I was born long, long ago. She said, 2 years ago? I said, no, longer than that. Then she suddenly switched subjects and said, why did you go to jail? I say, no, I didn't go to jail because I lied. Some people send me there. Who? People who don't like me. And she said, how long did you stay there? I said, well, again, I can't remember. But it was a very, very long time. She then said, very calmly and confident, you are a stupid old man, aren't you? Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you think like that lady, that the address I have delivered here makes me really a stupid man, please be a little more diplomatic than that young lady. Thank you.
I'm Thomas Roberts, and the Supreme Court is about to return monumental decisions on DOMA and Prop 8. Join me, another MS.
Our symbol and habitat is to say, can you? Thank you very much to you all. Thank you that you chose to care. Because you could have decided when by ending the system of white minority domination, humanity will have ensured that never again shall the scourge of racial tyranny raise its ugly head. You will all be welcome. You will all be welcome to attend those historic victory celebrations. I cannot complete my speech without referring to our comrade President Oliver Tambo. As you know, Comrade Oliver Tambo is recovering in a clinic in Sweden. I saw him in March of this year and was happy to see that he has made a remarkable progress in his illness. We know it is your desire, in fact, your prayers and wishes, that he should recover as speedily and completely, so that he can come back and lead this organization again. On my left is his beloved wife, Adelaide Tambo. In wishing our leader complete recovery, we at the same time would like to assure her that we are fully behind her and the family in their moment of concern. There is no man in this country and anywhere else in the world who could have performed as magnificently as he has done over the last 30 years. He kept our organization united and strong under the most difficult conditions. And we say, therefore, that our prayers are that he should be able to recover sufficiently to take his position of leadership of this organization. Finally, I want to tell you, as I have told many other meetings before, that we respect you, we admire you, and above all, we love you.
Tremendous reception for Nelson Mandela. He spoke for just over 20 minutes to an enraptured audience both here and around the world. I'm joined once more by Anthony Sampson, the writer and broadcaster we spoke to earlier. He is a lifelong friend of Nelson Mandela. A tremendous speech, first of all, but an important political and emotional tribute to Oliver Tambo.
It was very interesting because the atmosphere was unscripted and very spontaneous, and that, I think, sums up the strongest and most powerful emotion of that speech, which was of gratitude, because he feels, obviously, and he said so before, enormous gratitude to people who helped his organization and himself over almost 30 years. And of course, that is why he came here to Britain for this, when his own country was in a great state of tension. So that was by far the most powerful emotion that came through. And of course, Tambo was his lifelong companion as a lawyer, then as a co-leader of the ANC.
It was so obvious that Nelson Mandela was so happy to be here, and it was a very optimistic and strong speech.
The optimism, I thought, was also the most, that's the newest part, the most unexpected part, because he did say, as you remember, the dreams of millions of people to see our country free will be realized sooner rather than later. And that was after quite a militant previous lead-up.
Right.
And quite clearly, he does feel quite hopeful that there can be a really non-racial democracy in South Africa, perhaps within his own lifetime. And that's a rather remarkable conclusion to come to.
And of course, it also sets the tone for his meeting with Mrs. Thatcher next month, who has said last night that he does hope to meet the Prime Minister in May.
Yes, he's been much more conciliatory towards the British government than might appear, because in fact he has made a clear message that he does want to see Mrs. Thatcher, does not want to snub the government, and does look to that conciliation with many different kinds of people, as well as the audience here.
And it also must be remembered, of course, that the ANC is just one, albeit a very large one, of a number of parties who will be present at negotiations in South Africa.
Of course, South Africa is coming now towards a different phase of quite awkward negotiations with different black groups, as well as with the white minority and with the white rulers. And that will, of course, give it a perspective.
And how much do you think from the changes in South Africa, though, the unbanning of the ANC and the talks with de Klerk, how much do you think are those Nelson Mandela's personal achievements?
If one looks at the history of the last 3 or 4 years, it's clear that Mandela's impact personally on the South African government, and particularly on de Klerk, was a decisive factor in unbanning the ANC.
And we can see there that Nelson Mandela is leaving the stadium. In fact, he's going home to South Africa tonight. And it's worth pointing out that he has had almost unparalleled access to a worldwide audience for a politician.
people, and the message is within the music, and the music is within the message.
It's not just him coming now. I feel like all the brothers and sisters are going to come back, you know, just that in no time. As soon as you all Africans are organized, you know, the fire will be burning.
What do you remember the days of slavery?
It's very easy for a musician to know when he creates a good sound.
In all slavery,
strong with determination. now, and live at the greatest nation. Believe in yourself, and put love before vanity and wealth. Revelation, tell the little man, and I can show evidence that we got a God above all nations.
Human history that the apartheid crime ever occurred. It will forever remain an accusation and a challenge to all men and women of conscience that it took as long as it has before all of us stood up to say enough is enough. The date for the demise of the white minority regime has been determined, agreed, and set. 7 months from now, on April 27, 1994, all the people of South Africa, without discriminations on ground of agenda, race, color, or belief, will join in the historic act of electing a government of their choice. When distinguished leaders came together half a century ago to consign to the past a war that had pitted humanity against itself, the ruins and the smoke from the dying fires were the monument to what should not have been. The United Nations has to reassess its role, redefine its profile, and reshape its structures. It should truly reflect the diversity of our universe and ensure equity among the nations in the exercise of power within the system of international relations in general and the Security Council in particular. The very right to be human is denied every day to hundreds of millions of people as a result of poverty and the unavailability of basic necessities such as food, jobs, water and shelter, education, health care, and a healthy environment. As I sit in Kunu, my village, and grow as ancient as it feels, I will continue to entertain the hope that there has emerged a cadre of leaders in my own country and region, on my continent, and in the world, which will not allow that any should be denied their freedom, as we were, that any should be turned into refugees, as we were, that any should be condemned to go hungry, as we were, that any should be stripped of their human dignity, as we were.
The greatest nation. Believe in yourself and put love before vanity and wealth. Revelation tells in the moon and I can show everything, but we gotta rise above our nation. We gotta rise above foundation. From the 7 years and from the prison, right to the presidency. So we gotta rise above our nation. We gotta rise.
Welcome, a son. Rohilakla Dalibunga. Little did they know that the boy from Transkei would turn out to be one of the iconic figures of the 20th century, Nelson Mandela. He was born into the Madiba tribal clan of the Tembu people to Chief Henry Mgadla Mandela. At only 9 years old, his father died, and he was raised by the acting ruler of the Tembu people. He joined the Hillstown Methodist Boarding School before proceeding to the University College of Fort Hare, and later enrolled at the University of Witwatersrand, from where he graduated in law in 1942. At 25 years old in 1943, Mandela began what would later define his life. He joined the African National Congress as an activist and co-founded the ANC Youth League in 1944. The same year, he married his first wife, Evelyn Maffet. With rampant racial segregation, Mandela emerged as a strong opponent of the apartheid regime. Following the 1952 Defiance Campaign, he embarked on a countrywide crusade organizing resistance against discrimination. It landed him in trouble. A ban that confined him to Johannesburg for 6 months was imposed, but that did not deter him. He teamed up with Oliver Tambo and kept the campaign against apartheid alive. The 1955 Congress of the People marked a new beginning for the struggle that saw Mandela charged with treason, along with 155 other activists. The charges against him were dropped after a four-year trial. It may have served to fuel the resistance against the apartheid government, which gained momentum by the day. In the midst of the struggle, Mandela married his second wife, Winnie Madikizela, in 1958, a year after separating from his first wife, Evelyn Mathe, with whom they had three children. On the political front, tension with the apartheid regime escalated to new heights. The 1960 killing of 69 blacks in the Sharpeville massacre marked the end of a peaceful resistance.
There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people.
Mandela launched a campaign of sabotage against the country's economy, but the apartheid government moved to crack down on the resistance and banned the ANC. Mandela was briefly detained before he went underground, from where he pushed for the setting up of a military wing within the ANC. In 1961, Umkhonsawe was born. In 1962, Mandela left the country for military training in Algeria. Upon his return, he was captured and charged with leaving the country illegally and attempting to overthrow the government. Many leaders of Umkhonsawe were also arrested. He was convicted and jailed for 5 years in November 1962. While serving his sentence, he was charged in the Rivonia trial, and in the winter of 1964, Mandela was convicted of treason and sentenced to life in prison. He started his prison years in the infamous Robben Island prison, a maximum security facility on a small island off the coast of Cape Town. In the space of 12 months, between 1968 and 1969, Mandela's mother died and his eldest son was killed in a car crash, but he was not allowed to attend the funeral. Confined to a small cell, the floor for his bed, a bucket for a toilet, he was forced to do hard labor in a quarry, was allowed one visitor a year for 30 minutes. He could write and receive one letter every 6 months. Imprisonment did not send him into oblivion. He became a worldwide symbol of resistance to racism, and later, the world's most famous prisoner. In prison, Mandela rejected offers which included one by P.W. Botha for freedom if he renounced violence. He remained in prison on Robben Island for 18 years before being transferred to the Pulsmore prison in Cape Town in 1982. In December 1988, he was moved to the Victor Vester prison. As Mandela and other ANC leaders languished in prison or lived in exile, South Africa's black township children helped sustain the resistance. On the 2nd of February 1990, South African President F.W. de Klerk finally lifted the ban on the ANC and other anti-apartheid organizations. And after nearly 3 decades behind bars, Nelson Mandela walked to freedom from the Victor Vester prison on the 11th of February 1990, sending the country into a frenzy. In his first public address in 27 years, Mandela pushed the struggle agenda.
And Mr. Mandela must now stop with Walter.
after his release, Mandela and his delegation agreed to the suspension of the armed struggle. A new dawn for the nation beckoned. Nelson Mandela, Soweto's favorite son, was to play a leading role in the rebirth of South Africa, crowning in style a life of struggle and selflessness. Rita Kimina, NTV.
We're gonna ride. and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
The Nelson Mandela since he was jailed 27 years ago, and inevitably it was an emotionally and politically charged event. The setting was the garden of Archbishop Tutu's official residence in Cape Town. Here Nelson and Winnie Mandela strolled for the world's press. His family was here too for the full snapshot, grandchildren to the fore. And in a pose to be reproduced on 1,000 front pages, Mandela threw his clenched fist into the air in defiant freedom and held it there for what seemed a photographic age. But the politics of the gesture were infused with his own enjoyment of the humor of it all. As in his speech yesterday, his performance here was one of balance and moderation, a balance of peace, struggle, and forgiveness to his erstwhile captors. Almost immediately, he was pressed about his emotions in his new condition. But sudden freedom, after so long, was far from easy to describe.
I'm unable to describe my emotions. I am completely overwhelmed by the imperialism. That is something I did not expect. And I would merely emotionalize if I told you that I'm able to describe the own feelings. It has both devastating, that's all I can say.
Your best impression from the South African that you found is very short time as you can see.
Well, it's a totally different South Africa. And along the route, I was surprised to see the number of blacks who seem to identify themselves with what is happening when they come to go on these blocks. And the popular is occurring. And I expected that response from blacks, that the number of whites who seem to feel that the change is absolutely imperative surprised me.
Mr. Mandela does not disguise his sadness over the deprivation he has suffered in prison. He's philosophical about its impact, particularly on his children and his wife, Winnie.
Well, I have lost a great deal over the 27 years. And my life has been under all sorts of pressure. And it is not a nice feeling for me. But the human is family, struggling, without security, without the dignity of the head of the family, or around. But despite the hard time that I've had in prison, we have also had the opportunity to think of a problem. And it's an opportunity which is also very rewarding in that regard. And we learn to get used to circumstances. And in prison, there have been men who are very good, very good, in the sense that they understand the whole point of view, and they do everything to try and make you as happy as possible. And that is the one that I would on the street of Mount
The politics in this news conference centered first on whether he considered there was a conflict between striving for peace and sustaining the armed struggle against apartheid.
There is no conflict between those two statements. I have committed myself to the promotion of peace in the country. I have done so as part and parcel of the decisions and campaigns which have been taken and launched by the ANC. Let me point it out again. There is not a single political organization in this country, inside and outside Parliament, which can ever compare with the ANC in its total commitment to peace. And really, the unstable is merely defensive. It's a defensive act against a violent democratic. But we remain committed to peace. And if the government gives us the opportunity to remember the situation, we are ready to make a positive contribution towards a peaceful settlement of the problems of this country.
Repeatedly, he tried to reassure White to understand their misgivings.
He is very much concerned and address the question of the concern of rights. Over the demand of one person, one vote. And they insist on structural guarantees of the rights to ensure that the realization of this state of public demand does not result in the termination of rights by rights. We understand those fears, and that the ANC is concerned to address that problem and to find a solution which will suit both the blacks and the rights of the country.
People then wanted to know about his dialogue with the South African government during the last 3 years of his 27 years in jail. Meetings with cabinet ministers and with both President Botha and F.W. de Klerk. How many of these meetings have there been precisely, and with whom? And what have been the subject of negotiation?
Well, now that is a very good question, because there has been a lot of misunderstanding about it. I have been having discussions with the government for the last 3 years on two separate but related questions. The first one, in which I have been negotiating with the government, was the release of my colleagues, with the Sicilian office. As far as that is concerned, I have been negotiating. But the second issue has been one of a meeting between the ANC and the government. And there, I have been acting solely as a facilitator to bring the two major political and immigration bodies to the negotiating table.
Finally, talking of meetings, Mr. Mandela was diplomatic about how to respond to Mrs. Thatcher's invitation to Downing Street.
Well, an invitation from the British Prime Minister is something very important. And we can't treat it very lightly. But in this question, we have to be advised by the ANC.
I said earlier, Nelson Mandela is still on his way home to Soweto. He is already in Johannesburg, but staying in the suburbs in the north of the city. He's likely eventually to get here tomorrow afternoon.
We're gonna rise. We're gonna rise. We're gonna rise. stand up strong with determination. Look at us now, the leaders of the greatest nation. Believe in yourself and put love before vanity and wealth. Revelation, tell the living in a night and show evidence that we gonna rise above.
And from the prison, right to the presidency. So we gotta rise above our nation. We gotta rise above our nation.
Sacrificed the love of his life for a country that needed him more. This is the story of a remarkable man of the century who united a nation and inspired the world. The Long Walk of Nelson Mandela, tonight on Frontline. February 11th, 1990. The eyes of the world fixed on a prison near Cape Town.
No word as yet of Mr. Mandela.
It was a name that resonated in every corner of the planet.
We're waiting for the release of Mr. Mandela.
But the man behind the name remained a mystery.
Any moment now. Any moment.
Who had he become in the long years away? And could he live up to all the expectations? The last step on his walk to freedom had begun. The last time the world had seen him was three decades earlier on his way to court.
The accused are Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, Walter Max Ulyat Sisulu, Govan Archibald Mbeki, Dennis...
I remember the day we were arrested. I quickly went round our chairs and without saying a word, I indicated this.
They are charged on two counts of sabotage, one of contravening the suppression...
The penalty for sabotage was hanging.
...contravening the General Law Amendment Act.
There's no way in which we can avoid death penalty. And therefore, I should go to the gallows thing.
In his cell, Mandela labored at a speech that he would deliver from the dock.
My Lord, I'm the first accused.
It amounted to his political will and testament.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony.
I saw the speech. After he'd asked me to give some advice about it. It was fascinating to see it in his own handwriting. But then I thought how immensely honestly and clearly he saw his development from the tribal chief's son to the urban politician.
In my youth, I would sit and listen to the stories of the elders of my tribe, telling about the old days. The names of Dingani and Bambata, Hinta...
The name he was given at birth was Rolihlahla, Shaker of Trees, or Troublemaker.
He is of the royal house, as we are.
He grew up in the royal kraal of the Madiba clan. He had the privilege of a good education at mission school, and then at college. When he returned home, his guardian, Jongintaba, the regent king, expected him to become a tribal counselor. The king had chosen his bride-to-be.
He wanted to take that girl and get her married to Rolihlahla Mandela.
But Rolihlahla rebelled. Defying the king, he ran away.
He also told us that Mr. Mandela, the woman he was forced to marry was very, very ugly. You know, that was another reason why he had to run from Mkhwezulu to Joburg.
Mandela arrived in Johannesburg in 1941 with nothing but his suit and his aristocratic demeanor.
He was different. Mandela's clothes always looked as if they had been specially picked to fit him exactly. Where he picked it up, I don't know. It's just a characteristic of his. And maybe it's reflects a kind of ego.
In the city, he met a man who would shape his destiny. His name was Walter Sisulu.
I was an estate agent at the time, and I was also active in politics. And when a young man, a person of Nelson's nature, came, it was a godsend to me.
Sisulu had been looking, particularly among students, you know, as to whom they could entice on to the movement. Nelson was Walter's choice.
They told me he wanted to do law. And that fitted me too, because politics and law came together.
Walter Sisulu was in and out of our offices, and one day came along and he said, would I help a young man? He's from the Transkei, actually comes from royalty. Seeing that I'm doing so much black business, it could be useful, and could I article him? I promptly appointed him.
Mandela was living in a segregated township. He studied law by candlelight. Merging with the voteless masses, he faced the daily indignities of black urban life.
The humiliation, the anonymity, the jungle of Johannesburg, as it was then. I think there was more of a shock probably than Mandela's ever quite been able to describe. The city life made him feel that he was part of a much larger society who was suffering in a way that he hadn't properly comprehended or hadn't felt before he came to Johannesburg. So I think it was a combination of the personal humiliations, which were almost visible every day, together with the awareness of being part of this bigger scene.
When he joined, he was given money to go and buy some new teacups so that he should drink his tea in separate
cups to the
white.
Because in those days, obviously, the black influence had their own tin cups and the white influence had the china cups.
He was the tea man, Mandela. And he was told, now, these are the cups for the white people, and these are the cups for the black people. Those are your cups, you see. And along comes this man, and he takes one of the white cups. Mandela protests, no, these are your cups. His friends, they would say, that's nonsense, you see. That was one of his first political lessons.
Mandela's political tutor was Sisulu, a young star in the African National Congress.
I think Sisulu represented the mastery of the city and of the politics of the city. After all, at that time, Mandela was still the country boy. We would say he still is, but he was more obviously the country boy then, who didn't really know his way around town.
I thought Nelson had even better qualities than me. I was also encouraged by flexibility, by his ability to change, by his attitude to people. Amazing.
He was like a boxing manager with the champ. Sisulu talks about Mandela rather in that way, you know, he reports on his progress and he's doing even better than I expected.
Walter's spoken English was better than Nelson's spoken English, so although Nelson had a better education, he sorted him out and brightened him up, as it were, for the roles which he was to play.
Sisulu bought Mandela a suit for his graduation.
When he came to me for his testimonial, which was necessary for his admission as an attorney, I said, I'm sorry, I'm not giving it to you. So he said, why? I said, you're associated with Walter Sisulu. And please, Nelson, stand out as one black attorney who knows what to do and what not to do. You're doing well. You will do well. Please keep out of politics. He hesitated. He said, all right. This is the first lie he told me, I think, that he ever told me.
Mandela was, in fact, emerging as a leader in his own right and already getting into arguments with his mentor, Sisulu.
The debate was whether Africans should fight alone or alongside Indians and whites. Mandela, the proud tribal leader, was staunchly in the Africanist camp.
The question of Indians and whites disturbed him in one way, that they would undermine that pride in him to do something as a leader of the African people.
Mandela was going for the communists and going for the Indians. He grabbed hold of Yusuf Kassala off a platform and threw him off as though he were a dog, you know. And of course, he was a big, strong man.
When Nelson's suspicions about the Indians came to the fore, it was Walter who said to him, these guys are good, you know, they mean well, they're with us. And Nelson didn't believe him, he was very skeptical.
Mandela changed his mind in the face of a new government repression. The African population especially hated the pass laws. They controlled their movements and kept them out of white areas. Failure to carry the passbooks risked arrest and imprisonment. The ANC rose up against the system that came to be known as apartheid.
In Johannesburg, there was staged last weekend the first move in a campaign that may lead to civil disobedience. Thousands of colored people went to attend a protest meeting called by the African National Congress. This campaign would urge all colored people to break the unjust laws and to court arrest.
That moment marks a very important step in the movement of...
Mandela, pas un dit que
and from the prison right to the presidency. So we gonna ride
of imagery. He always looked right for the part. His smile, which was almost too good to be true, you know, that wide, white smile, was well a showman's or showbiz smile, perhaps, which made some people, including myself, a bit sceptical about what really lay behind the show.
Behind it was, for those times, an extraordinary ambition.
Mandela made a speech as leader of the Youth League in which he predicted that he would be the first president of South Africa. Now, this was quite resented because you had the leader of the ANC there, you had the leader of the provincial ANC, my father, there, and then you had this upstart Mandela getting up and as part of his speech saying that he is looking forward to becoming the first president of a free republic of South Africa.
Within the confines of apartheid Johannesburg, he was already a king of the city.
The first time when I saw him, it was at the Bantamain Social Center. He was tall, elegantly dressed. I wanted to know who he was and what he was doing. So they said he's an outstanding African leader.
With Adelaide's husband, Oliver Tambo, he set up a law firm. Among the small black elite, he was an admired figure.
Are you saying your latest man? And was proud of it, and he took tremendous troubles with his appearance, and was tremendously admired by many women, without question.
He was, however, married to Evelyn, a relative of Sisulu's. They had three children. At home in Soweto, they fought over other women and his all-consuming political work. She left, they separated. Mandela now shared his bed with a friend.
He had a very big bed, thank God. I mean, he put his head on the pillow and he was gone. He slept, but woke up sharply just before his exercises had to start.
He had taken up boxing to keep fit.
He was fond of being completely naked than washing himself all over, you see. I feel a bit uneasy, but he was very, was sort of almost showing off, you know, his lovely body.
The boxer dropped his guard in the summer of 1957.
It was raining hard one afternoon. Oliver greeted from inside the car and he said, this is Winnie Matikizala from Bizana. And Nelson answered, oh, I tell you what I noticed. As the car was pulling away, he was standing on the pavement. And he watched the car move. I also saw Winnie turning back and looking at him.
Winnie was 22, 16 years younger than Nelson.
She was wonderfully shy and beautiful and didn't have much to say for herself then. Nelson did a lot of the talking.
No, she had never a shy girl. From the word go, she was, I mean, obviously community oriented. She was a social worker. She could speak. She was articulate.
Winnie didn't know how to drive a car. Nelson decided to teach her, never realizing that that lesson would bring out all the fire between them, but in a manner which was different from the fire in the bedroom. So there was this conflict. He found her almost unteachable. One thing often recurs when he talks about her to her, he often says, you are highly undisciplined.
The rules of the love affair were dictated by Mandela's unbreakable contract with his political cause. She would battle to find her place among the dominant figures of the African resistance.
I know that Moses Kotane made a terrible statement when Nelson introduced her, and he said that such beauty does not suit a revolutionary. Nelson had thought that very amusing and turned around and repeated that to Winnie. Winnie had been furious. Winnie always wanted to be understood and accepted beyond her physical appearance. She wanted to be accepted for herself. She was a very strong personality all along.
She would need all that strength. The wedding pictures did not reveal the security policemen who were mingling with the guests. At the reception, Winnie's father warned, this marriage will be no bed of roses. It is threatened from all sides.
It happened on Monday, March 21st, 1960.
In the township of Sharpeville, a protest against pass laws sparked a ferocious response.
Police mounted on tanks opened fire. 69 natives were killed, 176 wounded. Most of the victims were shot in the back. Some of the dead were children, women.
The government proclaimed a state of emergency and declared the ANC illegal. A new era of repression had begun. Mandela evaded arrest, Leaving Winnie with two baby girls, he went underground. He hid in a white suburb in the apartment of a young communist. Outside, the crackdown continued.
A message came through about some Africans who got killed by the police. And he paced up and down, you know, the flat, and I could see he was fuming, you know. And then he blurted out, he said, you know, Wolfie, one day I'm telling you it's going to be an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And he kept on pacing. About an hour afterwards, he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, Wolfie, I didn't mean that at all. I could never do that. Interesting, isn't it?
Walled inside the apartment, Mandela was straining to stay loyal to the ANC principle of nonviolence. He summoned the media to help him push a reluctant ANC down a new road.
I went to see the 42-year-old African lawyer, Nelson Mandela, the most dynamic leader in South Africa today. The police were hunting for him at the time, but African nationalists had arranged for me to meet him at his hideout. He is still underground.
The reporter was taken to Wolfie Kodesh's apartment.
Is there any likelihood of violence?
There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against the government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider, in the light of our experiences, whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
A stormy debate ensued within the ANC. Mandela was reprimanded, but his arguments prevailed. He was secretly appointed commander-in-chief of the new armed wing, Umkhonto Wesizwe, spear of the nation. The lawyer was going to war.
I said, have you read this class of it, which I had? It's like reading Shakespeare for English classics. You have to read class of it for warfare, you know. And I took it out and gave it to him. And he said, can I underline everything in this book? So I said, sure, you do what you like. He sat there making notes for days on end.
The next step put theory into practice at a deserted brickyard. Mandela, Kodesh, and a World War II veteran, Jack Hodgson, drove out to test their first bomb.
We went on the fringes of the brickwork and put the canister down into the hole. Nothing happened. So we had to get down into the hole to bring it up again, and then Hodgson sort of adjusted it. Just put down again in the hole. I think it must have been about 10 seconds when there was this terrific rock. But the dust just blows up. We tumbled into the car. He was overjoyed. He was congratulating everyone.
The targets were identified. Installations initially, not people. Mandela and the high command mapped out a sabotage campaign. The date for the first attacks was December 16th, 1961.
From the beginning, Mandela did envisage the guerrilla army developing out of this. Others thought we were only going to employ violence on symbolic targets. But Mandela was never a pacifist or someone who was worried about loss of life.
The bombs rattled the white government. Among blacks, Mandela's legend grew. To the police, he was South Africa's most wanted man. The press dubbed him the Black Pimpernel. Mandela escaped the country and flew north to get backing from Africa's freedom movements to build his dream of a guerrilla army.
There was some optimism throughout the whole of Africa about victories being quite soon and quite rapid and also quite painless. In South Africa, a lot of black politicians were misled by that, including Mandela, to think it was going to be an easy walk to freedom.
In Algeria, he learned to handle weapons, but his trainers poured cold water on his hope of defeating apartheid by force of arms. In London, he met up with his old partner, Oliver Tambo, now leading the ANC in exile. After 6 months abroad, Mandela stole back into South Africa, summoned to a farmhouse in Rivonia, north of Johannesburg, where Walter Sisulu and other ANC underground leaders had set up their clandestine headquarters.
He took chances. He would have the family visit him over weekends when he would take the children over there.
These snatched embraces would be their last intimacy for a long, long time. Caged in his Rivonia hideout, Mandela was arguing with his comrades again. He was itching to risk a cross-country trip to report on his African mission to the older leaders of the ANC.
My view was that he should not go. He was already well known. His photographs had appeared, and this beard was very well known. And we had suggested that he should shave off that beard. He refused. He is not without some weaknesses, one of which is vanity. That is the name.
We're gonna rise.
27 years, and from the prison right to the presidency. So we gonna ride
to go down.
He drove 300 miles to the city of Durban.
Where was this party? We all arrived here. All his friends. We had a lovely, lovely party, and there he was all dressed up in his guerrilla uniform, looking very splendid, very broad-shouldered, not the man you see today. His face also was, you know, rounder. And then he left from that house.
The police were waiting for him. The state lacked evidence to link him to sabotage. The charges were leaving the country illegally and inciting strikes. At the trial, he would respond by turning the law court into a political stage.
I can never forget this. It was amazing. When he came up, you know, and he's this tall, big, athletic man. He had a, like a caross, you know, like a skin across here. Beads around his neck, beads around his arm. As he came up, there was a complete hush. And even the policemen, they went pale to see this huge man in his national costume. And that magistrate just looked and he couldn't find his voice.
He went with this speech, "I'm a black man in a white man's court." It electrified the nation.
He was sentenced to 5 years.
Madiba is now in prison, but the Walters and all are around. Don't worry. Madiba is not even going to serve his 5 years. We're getting him out of prison. We're taking the country the Castro way. Our songs were one stick, two sticks, six sticks of dynamite. We take the country the Castro way.
It would never happen. Sisulu and the others continued unaware that the police noose was tightening. When the police raided, they caught the core of the underground leadership. They found a treasure of evidence, including maps and papers linking Mandela to plans for a guerrilla war. This time, Mandela and the others faced death by hanging.
They all put on a brave front, but we were very concerned. We discussed whether or not we should immediately give notice of appeal if the death sentence was imposed. They unanimously decided that we should not.
My lord, I am the first accused.
In his cell, Mandela drafted a speech whose words would ring around the world. Less a defense than a manifesto, he strove to end his performance not with a plea, but with a challenge.
I have cherished the ideal for a free and democratic society. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
When we got the first draft, a shiver went down my back and I said, Nelson, you know that this may be misinterpreted and they'll say that you are actually seeking martyrdom. I don't like it.
You can't say to the judge you can do what you damn well want to do, which was the effect of what Nelson had put in his original draft. And then I introduced my wording, which was softer, if need be, so let it be.
Mbeki and Bezos prevailed. The court delivered its judgment.
I am by no means convinced that the motive of the accused were as altruistic as they wished the court to believe. The sentence in the case of all the accused would be one of life imprisonment.
There was jubilation because we thought that the struggle was still going to be longer than we had thought, but it was still going to be victorious. So they had lived and we would see them alive.
I shall never lose hope and my people shall never lose hope. In fact, we expect that the work will go on.
The prisoners set off on a long journey. Their destination, an island in the South Atlantic, off the coast of Cape Town.
On the 15th of June 1964, very early in the morning, we were flown to Robben Island. We arrived there, I think, at about 9:15 in the morning. Extremely cold today. They said it was the coldest day, I think, in 10 years or something. Our morale came down. We realized that we are going to be here for a very, very long time.
Robben Island was the prison where South Africa banished its most dangerous criminals. The new political prisoners were put to hard labor in a quarry. Mandela was 46 years old.
When you think back to it, you know, you almost can't believe that you survived it, you know. that made us fill a wheelbarrow as a unit standard with crushed stone. And the pace at which you had to do it and no intervals, nothing of that kind, were allowed.
You're told to produce so much of the lime, and if you don't produce that amount, you're going to be punished. In a working quarry, we were ordered to not every time I stopped to rest. They could only stop to go to the toilet. If I took a break at any other time, they were charged.
Communication between prisoners was forbidden. They had to work and eat in silence.
My dearest Winnie, I have not had a letter from you. I feel as dry as a desert. Letters from you are like the arrival of summer rains and spring that enliven my life. I become full of love.
Mandela could only send or receive letters once every 6 months. Each one was closely read, copied, and passed on to be read again by the security police. Suspicious phrases were cut out and filed. Letters were held back, sometimes destroyed. Prisoners were not allowed to own watches. The pace of life was dictated by sirens or shouts from the warders.
We couldn't afford to think of a life sentence in real terms, that it meant just what it said, that life. It was, in fact, a condition of our survival in prison to believe that we'd be out of prison during our lifetime. Nelson actually lived that belief.
My darling Winnie, I have been fairly successful in putting on a mask behind which I have pined for the family alone, never rushing for the post when it comes until somebody calls out my name. I'm struggling to suppress my emotions as I write this letter.
Mandela's self-control was tested. A telegram arrived saying his firstborn son, Tembi, had died in a car crash.
Walter went into his cell. He told Walter what had happened. And Walter, of course, conveyed this to us. But he doesn't show this emotion. He feels it deep down inside. But he doesn't show it.
Mandela was refused permission to attend the funeral. His son had never forgiven him for sacrificing his family on the battleground of politics.
Suppose your next of kin has passed away. You fail to contain yourself. Your enemy will get a chance and strike. But if you can contain your emotions, he won't be able to do that. To try at you.
Mandela's enemies did use his family to try and strike at him. A newspaper cutting appeared mysteriously in his cell. Winnie had been cited in a divorce.
Although it had been made to look as if someone had just slipped it there, it had deliberately been put there so that Nelson could see it and so that it would hurt him.
One of the strategies that the system used was to try and torment him to torture him with stories about her infidelity. And I don't think Nelson could take that. It really upset him very much.
The article alleged that Winnie had been having an affair with a man identified by other prisoners as a police informer.
He made a point of calling us in and talking to us about it because he felt that it was politically essential and that kind of information should not affect our attitude towards the ANC.
Whether he believed it or not, Mandela defended his wife.
It wasn't the reaction of a cuckold. He took the blame immediately. He felt that it was through his neglect that his wife may have been tempted, he didn't say she was, may have been tempted to do what she was alleged to have done.
He stood by his wife, Winnie,
and did him for much.
I think, in fact, his relationship with his wife became stronger.
Mandela would never forget the warder's attempts to rob him of his dignity. It was something he wrote in his autobiography that he would not part with at any price.
I remember when I first went to Robben Island, and I'd been working with him for some months, and he's a big man in every way. And when one of the warders took me to his cell and opened the door, I gasped when I saw it. It wasn't room for a human being, much less Nelson Mandela, this outsized human being. And in a strange way, that cell modeled him. His world became constricted. And in a way, that allowed him to become bigger because it gave him self-control.
Prison disciplined his militancy, compelling him to devise new strategies for engaging with the enemy.
There was really a war of nerves between the warders and ourselves. And it was a question of who was going to set the pattern. Mandela made the point. You say that you run, you insist on walking. In the same as you walk fast, you insist on walking slowly.
Mandela quite emotional.
The greatest nation. Believe in yourself. and to love the profanity and well. Revelation tells a little man and I can show evidence that we gotta rise above.
I used to drive them to the quarry. I was ordered to give them a rough ride so they wouldn't be touched. One day he knocked on my window and demanded, "What the hell do you think we are? Bag of corn?" I just wound up my window and drove off.
Nelson got so fed up with water that he actually got up and said, "Look, you don't dare talk to us like that," and went for him. So I then asked Mandela afterwards, I said, "But you know, what happened there? Why did you do that?" And he said to me, and I'll never forget, he said to me, "No, this was very deliberate, you know." And I must say, I didn't initially believe him. But when I thought about it, you know, he is so deliberate.
Step by measured step, he was imposing his will on his captors.
There were 8 warders with him. Prisoners usually do not set the pace at which they move with their warders. But it was quite obvious that he was. Nelson said hello. He then pulled himself back and said, "George, I'm sorry. I have not introduced you to my guard of honor. They actually behaved like a guard of honor. I respectfully shook my hand.
One of the things that Robin Island taught him is that if he maintained his dignity, if he insisted on being treated the way a man should be treated, then he could bend the authorities on Robin Island to his will. These are the most unrepentant racists in the world. And if they can treat me with dignity and be taught to treat me with dignity, as he did teach them, then he realized he could do it in the wider world.
12 years had passed since Mandela had been banished to the island. Throughout South Africa, his words, even his image, were banned. To a young generation growing up in Soweto, or men,
Mandela was no longer using, full of dust. His legal gown, his chair. This is Mandela fit. Here is a doorknob which he used to open every morning as the father of the house.
It was the children of Soweto who were to resurrect the cause. Not far from Mandela's house, high school students gathered to protest their inferior education. It was the start of the rebellion of 1976. Thousands fled the country. The young leaders were arrested and thrown into prison.
We could not wait to get to Robben Island, largely because we've heard about Nelson Mandela. It was something that we looked forward to, almost like the culmination of one's initiation, you know, as young people. When we arrived there, a lot of us are young. Our hands are still smelling of gunpowder. We want to cause strikes in prison. We want to take over. We want to run our lives here.
Ours was an aggressive approach. We ended up on the hunt. We refused to work. We refused to be locked up. We did all those kinds of things, which was very different from the way in which Nelson Mandela was doing it. This group had become so isolated from the rest of the world. Years that would be 50, come, what was that even?
Although Chad Yeavers had gone, he had mailed complaints to Dutton Park, Venturger, Mr.
The crew came in, warders came into the center, shine your shoes and put on your jackets and dress up smartly. I said, to hell with it. Kruger duly came in, and I just lolled on my bed reading a magazine. But the moment he passed my door, I got up and I looked, and there was Nelson standing at attention. And I just thought, phew. I mean, I certainly didn't come to Robben Island to see all my dreams, my vision of a great revolutionary shattered like this.
Winning over the young rebels was the new test of Mandela's leadership.
There were prisoners who constantly got into an altercation with the prison warders and were punished. Mandela understood and never said that's a wrong reaction. What he did begin to say was, you are not controlling that response.
Mandela, the point really was, look, you're going to kill yourselves. These people are going to punish you until you collapse, and then you wouldn't have gained anything from imprisonment, whereas we can actually gain something from this.
Outside, the clampdown continued.
I remember going back to South Africa. Mandela's name was not mentioned at all, even amongst black friends. The effectiveness of that embargo, of that law, of course, which forbade the mention, was amazing. He was in a gulag in the Russian sense. To all intents and purposes, he had been forgotten.
In 1977, there was an unusual invitation to a group of journalists.
We got a call one day from the Information Ministry saying, you're really going to have to come on this one.
This secret film, taken by a government cameraman, would remain hidden for two decades.
I have invited the local and foreign news media to visit to ascertain for themselves the true treatment circumstances of the prisoners incarcerated there for offenses against the security of the state.
And we all drew film. They led us around, there were some guys selling all these in the kitchens. Kitchen was very neat and tiny. And we walked through the various corridors and past the cells. And we said, where's Mr. Mandela's cell? There's Mr. Mandela's cell.
466, that is prison number.
But his mat on the floor and then the blankets, and pictures of women, and tomatoes. I checked all his books that he had there, all the reading material, the legal books and the economics books. He didn't see anybody. He kept saying, where are the prisoners? Oh, they are just on the island doing their daily tours. Where's Mr. Manila? And he said, well, he's on the island. Yes, he's here. Can you see him? No, you can't, because that's a prisoner's privilege, not to talk to anybody without his permission. So he said, yeah, get out of here. You put him here, you can really relax. No, but I'm terribly sorry, but the rules say we can't. Ah, we said, he's dead. Christ, that really got a jump out of him. He said, no, absolutely not. He's perfectly healthy. He's very good health. Once, let's have a look at him. No. But he nagged him. Finally, he said, well, okay, he's over there. And we turned. We were just on the outside of the building. We turned. And behind the rocks, or next to the rocks, was Nelson Mandela. Some idiot from the Afrikaans press ran over to him, shouting in Afrikaans, Meneer Mandela, ons wil met u gesels. Well, Nelson just looked at them, saw a whole bunch of propaganda hacks, and wouldn't talk, wouldn't say anything. And that was it. They were handing out photographs that were taken by an information department photographer. And I said, can I have that photograph? Who is this person? I said, that's Nelson Mandela. No, they said, it's not. And they quickly went with a black pen and blacked out his face. And I smashed the picture and took out my handkerchief and tried to clean it. Well, the black pen won out.
Nelson Mandela had been on Robben Island for 13 years. Contact with the outside world was severely restricted. Winnie traveled over 1,000 miles from Soweto for encounters limited to 30 minutes.
Every visit that Winnie made, she made it a special event. She dressed up to please Nelson. The short time that they spent together, even though it was divided by the glass pane, it was a very important event. After each visit, Nelson would write her a letter recounting the visit. He would savor it.
You looked really wonderful, very much like the woman I married. Your beautiful photo still stands above my left shoulder as I write this note. I dust it carefully every morning, for to do so gives me the pleasant feeling that I'm caressing you as in the old days. I even touch your nose with mine to recapture the electric current that used to flush through my blood whenever I did so.
Since Mandela's imprisonment, Winnie, left alone with two young children, had been beaten, imprisoned, held in solitary confinement, and put under house arrest. In 1977, she was banished with her younger daughter, Zinzi, to a remote country town far from her Soweto home.
Winnie was absolutely irresistible copy at that time while she was down in Brantford. For one thing, the security police and the dirty tricks operators kept attacking her, and they burnt her clinic and all sorts of things. It suddenly became a very attractive story. Everybody started flocking down to Brantford. And Winnie then got on TV, foreign TV, and she was a celebrity in no time at all. It was a media event. They made presentations to her, and senators were seeing her. She was suddenly famous, and that did as much as anything to reignite the international image of Nelson Mandela.
Winnie Mandela is a source of inspiration for people all over the world. She has demonstrated by her life and her love of her family and love of her husband.
How was the meeting, Senator?
Winnie looked like a queen. She held court. I mean, she was the star. She reawakened dramatically the name of Mandela, and she spoke in his name.
There will be a one man, one vote in this country, and there will be a majority government in this country. But that majority government will accommodate everybody.
Led by
Mandela.
In the 80s, people were on the march again. The spirit of resistance caught fire. The youth heeded a call from the exiled ANC to make the townships ungovernable. Breaking free from Bamford, Winnie emerged as a leader in her own right.
We're gonna rise above our nation. We're gonna rise against foundation.
Mandela gives a commitment that he will not make himself guilty of planning, instigating, or committing acts of violence for the furtherance of political objectives, I will in principle be prepared to consider his release.
My father says, but let him renounce violence. Yes. Let him say that he will dismantle apartheid.
Through his daughter Zinzi, Mandela issued his first public statement in 21 years.
My father says, your freedom and mine cannot be separated. I will return.
Behind the public sparring, the idea was beginning to form of making a more discreet approach. In the early 80s, Mandela, Sisulu, and three others had been moved from the island to a prison on the mainland. Then in 1985, Mandela was admitted to a whites-only hospital in Cape Town for prostate surgery. Winnie flew down to see him. The Minister of Justice just happened to have been on the same plane.
All of a sudden, I became aware of the presence of this very interesting and imposing woman. I recognized her, of course, immediately. And there she was standing, and she didn't speak a word. She just indicated with her head that I was near the briefcase. She wanted to sit next to me. I did so, and she sat next to me for the remainder of the flight.
There has been no such suggestions whatsoever.
There's no negotiation to that.
Not to me, at all.
But encouraged by Winnie, the minister hours later paid a secret visit to Mandela's private ward.
He was sitting in a chair in a corner, hospital attire, but even that he wore with dignity. He was obviously well liked by the hospital personnel, and yet he was suspected, even though they knew that he was a prisoner.
They had all along believed that this was a fierce, radical, frightening, you know, revolutionary. On meeting him, they discovered he was a reasonable man, he understood white fears. That was when the idea started to come out, to see if we can't lure him into something.
In Polsmoor Prison, Mandela and his comrades had been sharing a large cell. When he returned from the hospital, he was isolated from them.
They didn't bring him back to us. So our instinct was to protest about this, that he was being punished. In retrospect, he already had in mind what he was going to do. Because when we said we wanted to protest, we said, cool it, chaps, something good may come from here.
And he realized, this is an opportunity. I'm by myself. I can do some things now that my colleagues, my trusted and close colleagues cannot see, because I'm not sure that they are ready to see this. A man from the ANC talking to the government about some kind of new dispensation. I mean, that was anathema.
Alone, Mandela took a historic decision. He wrote to Coetzee proposing talks. Outside, the violence that Mandela had once encouraged was leading the country to the precipice. For a year he waited. Then one night, he was dressed in a suit and taken to the minister's home.
My first objective was to be on equal footing with him. So, amongst other things, we prepared tea and snacks. We chatted for some time.
What they were saying to him, you have an existence independent of this organization. You come with us. And we will settle the matter. All would go well.
He wanted me to accept that the ANC was interested in good governance, democracy, and that violence was not really on their agenda.
So there they were, sort of sparring with each other, each trying to draw the other across to their point of view. He hoped that he could engage them into serious negotiations about unbanning the ANC and releasing prisoners and that kind of thing. So it was very much a case of, you know, who was the fish and who was the angler in this.
For the next year, alone, he continued to meet secretly. Mandela the prisoner was persuading the government to recognize his status as a leader. Now he had to tell his own comrades.
So he took this first step without us knowing. They wouldn't allow him to see us together, that you can see them one by one. That's how he told us what he had done. And we reacted differently, of course. We were on different wavelengths. I had completely opposed this thing. I couldn't understand why he did not consult the comrades with whom he was on and at Polesmo, except to say, which was his explanation, that he had given an undertaking to the cabinet ministers that he would not disclose the contents to anybody else.
Mbeki smuggled a message out to the ANC in exile. Mandela's old friend Oliver Tambo, now the ANC president, sent a secret note back questioning his judgment.
The ANC is a long tradition of collective leadership. And suddenly you had one of the leaders isolated, being drawn into a situation which was clearly a trap.
The reports were filtered to him that there was a concern that in his isolation he may be manipulated. He would chuckle at that and indicate, well, they don't have to worry. There was any manipulation, it was the other way around.
In July 1988, Mandela turned 70. With the ANC's blessing, concerts and demonstrations were held in celebration around the world. Mandela had become the defining image of the liberation struggle. But the actions of Mandela the man were causing grave disquiet.
Within the ANC, there was tremendous antagonism to him. People who thought he might have sold out. People who thought that he was too inflated with himself. There were so many rivalries, and there were so many people who were conspiring against him. He was very depressed.
He was brought up in an environment of chieftaincy. There, he could do things without consultation. This was telling also on his style of work within the ANC.
Now, I regard that as one of the most outstanding, courageous moments when a man is alone in the face of that situation. Particularly in politics, where you got a lot of criticism from Africa, he was confident of what line he was following.
Mandela suddenly fell ill with tuberculosis. The news spread alarm in the government.
Behind it all was this terrible fear on the part of the government that Mandela might die on them in prison. There's no way that the world wouldn't have believed they'd killed him. And they were absolutely terrified of the consequences, the international consequences of that, and of the explosion of the black population in South Africa.
The government took an extraordinary step. They moved him to a house in the grounds of Victor Verster Prison, Guards from Robben Island were assigned to watch over him.
When
does it this kind?
It mag nooit geweest zijn, maar ze spreken zeker nooit Engels.
I was told to only watch what they did. I was instructed not to listen to what they were saying. There were bugging devices that picked up everything that was said.
Every sound in the house was recorded by 4 government intelligence agencies. Even the trees were bugged.
I was aware of the fact that it was monitored, but he also knew that. He also knew that.
He could receive visitors at his new home. Even prisoners from Robben Island.
We're happy to see him so healthy. He forgot every other thing. Embraced him. And we wanted to sing our revolutionary songs, all of us. And he started showing us around. This is where I am. It's a beautiful house. Oh my God, there's a pool here. So our excitement begins to recede and the suspicions come. And I thought, I think he has sold out.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. Here is Nelson at the door to receive you, immaculately dressed in a 3-piece suit, and you wonder what on earth is going on here.
Winnie was even allowed to stay overnight, but she refused. He could follow news of the outside world on TV, including reports about Winnie's team of bodyguards, whom she called the Mandela United Football Club. Accusations flew of abductions, beatings, and the murder of a young activist, Stompie Sapé.
He was very upset. He was very unsettled.
He was upset about the Stompie story.
Yeah, that come.
He ordered her to come.
It was the first time he was in the camp.
It was the first.
Compared to mine, Africa is my home.
27 years, I'm from the prison, the right to the presidency. So we gonna rise above the nation. We gonna rise.
I could hear him shouting. Later, when I came out, you could see that he'd been crying. He was very upset about the Stompy incident. After that, when he didn't come and visit, he would ask why she didn't come. She would always have excuses. I realized that things were not going well between them anymore.
The state was privy not just to Mandela's personal anguish, but to the political conflicts he was having with his skeptical comrades.
Mandela had said the enemy is not surrendering. All he's left with is his army. Intact, thought Mandela said. All the enemy can do is to go for a scorched earth policy and ruin the country that we have struggled for so long.
Mandela needed results.
Mr. Mandela became aggressive. On not being allowed the opportunity of discussing with Mr. Botha.
Finally, Barnard did fix a meeting. The two men argued in the car. Mandela had been demanding the release of Walter Sisulu as a sign of the government's serious intentions.
I tried to convince him, don't mention Walter Sisulu. Listen to me, I know what is going on. If you mention the release of Walter Sisulu, Mr. Botha will say no.
I asked Mandela, what was his thinking before his first meeting with P.W. Botha? And he then said to me, the one thing he knew that he was never going to allow was the way P.W. Botha had treated other African leaders, where he had lectured them. He was never going to be allowed to treat me like that.
Well, so approach is ever to say, how are you? How are you? There was almost relief on both sides. I always have a vivid picture of that, of the relief between the two men. He spoke of P.W. Botha with such veneration, such affection. Why? Because the day that he met P.W., P.W. walked halfway across the room with his hand out to shake hands. P.W. had acted like a gentleman and had treated him like a gentleman. It started off quite well, and then Mr. Mandela raised the issue of Sisulu. Strangely enough, Mr. Botha listened and he said, but Bernard, I think we must help him. I think it must be done. You will give some attention to that.
Mandela had been the first to offer peace talks, but it was Botha's government that made the first major concession. Within 3 months of the meeting, Walter Sisulu and the rest of the Rivonia prisoners would be released.
Mandela decided to go and say to the enemy, here's a white flag. I know you're afraid, but raise the flag. He blinked on behalf of the enemy, and therefore gave the enemy the chance to retreat.
Botha fell ill and resigned, but his meeting with Mandela had raised new expectations. His successor, F.W. de Klerk, arrived at the presidency, a politician born and bred in the conservative wing of the National Party. He was under irresistible pressure at home and abroad to act quickly.
In exactly the same way as when Gorbachev embarked on his perestroika and glasnost, he certainly didn't have in mind the collapse of the Soviet Union and the whole Soviet Empire. De Klerk came in there with a very, very convoluted concept. Anything they didn't like, anything that was going to change the structures of the status quo, they'd be able to veto. But first of all, let's get the West on our side. Let's do the big deed, make a huge splash.
The government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. I'm serious about bringing this matter to finality without delay.
Any moment now. Any moment. There's Mr. Mandela. Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man, taking his first steps into a new South Africa. That is the man who the world has been waiting to see.
He said he really was amazed. It was multiracial. But so many white people. He really was, well, I mean, he was over the moon, but he was also genuinely quite taken aback.
He had no tears on Robin Allen. He could feel them welling, but they didn't come out. There he was. All we could do was to hug one another and then shout, say anything. It's done. He's free.
I fear that I may have to make a speech at his funeral whilst he was in jail. That was the phobia that I lived with all the years. To see them free was really the realization of a dream for me.
In Cape Town, a vast crowd waited all day for Mandela's first speech. The government was anxious.
Will it be possible for us to go through the next 24, 48, 72 hours without a major people's uprising, creating momentum? The one wave becomes two, and the two becomes four, and four becomes eight.
Mandela had become such a magical man that the day he was released, everything would be all right. It would all come right. We knew it wasn't going to get fixed in a day. But the expectations were such that this was going to be like the second coming of Christ.
I stand here before you, not as a prophet, but as a humble servant of you, the people.
Welcome!
The next day, Mandela returned to the home in Soweto he had left three decades earlier.
They were as one. I'm very happy to be together. Winnie looking like a very shy bride, talking about how she doesn't know whether she should bring his slippers to his bedside or his clothes to him, you know, dutiful wife.
My first impression of him was that he was very quiet. He was listening to everybody very carefully. And then something quite incredible happened. He called her, Zami, and she said, yes, Tata, and he asked her something about making tea for the visitors. And I thought that was absolutely quite incredible. Now, he walked back into his house and took charge as the head of the house in a home where Winnie was the head of the house for many years. Winnie had grown into a very different person, very independent in her own right, also very adored by ordinary South African people. It was going to be very difficult for them to continue a relationship that hadn't been there for 27 years.
Things fell apart between them because Nelson was now the supreme negotiator. And he also felt that during that period, he should observe law and order of the apartheid state. Because things were about to change. That made sense. Winnie still had that rebellious streak in her. And there were a lot of people who were like her, who didn't quite identify with the negotiation process that was going on. So there was a cleavage.
The marriage came under visible strain. Winnie was facing charges in connection with the Stompie Sepe murder.
She believed so in Winnie that she could never have done what the people were saying. All along at that period, he did believe in her. He asked people to go to court to show support for her.
One of the things he would always say to me, what Winnie went through was much worse than what I went through. She's in solitary confinement for a year and a half. Why? I married her. She's separated from her children for, you know, months on end. Why? I married her. So I think he felt a lot of good old-fashioned guilt about that.
The trial went on for 4 months.
He couldn't carry on living with Winnie under the same roof. She never went to bed unless he was asleep. He felt that she never wanted confrontation. She never wanted him to talk to her about anything. She never gave him the chance to.
Winnie was found guilty of assault and kidnapping, but got off with a suspended sentence. Then, one of her lawyers in the trial accompanied her on a trip to America.
She was going abroad, and she was then taking a friend with her, Dali and Mpofu with her, and he specifically asked her not to do that. And she said she wouldn't. He phoned her one night. Dali answered the telephone.
Winnie had written Mpofu a love letter, which Nelson would have to read in the press.
He loved her very deeply. And I don't think it's a hurt that he will have got over easily. You don't want me to talk to you about things that he would have shared really in very, very strict confidence. Things that a man doesn't usually tell another man about things that are happening at home. He loved her very, very deeply. Yeah.
It didn't happen all of a sudden. She moved out of the house. She pleaded with him to return. And he didn't. And then you had the break.
Just as he had always done, Mandela consulted with Sisulu and the others to consider the political consequences. They joined him at a press conference.
My love for her remains undiminished. However, we have mutually agreed that a separation would be best for each one of us.
What he hated about that, and what he hated about Winnie, is that she forced him to show emotion in public in a way that he never wanted to.
He left her to the
judicial. That's what he hated.
To determine. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll appreciate the pain I have gone through. And I now end this interview.
Thank you very much.
I think the period after the separation from Winnie was probably the loneliest of all. And that was the worst of all periods. After all, it was an extraordinary time, really, to be the most famous man in the world, but when you were also the loneliest one.
Brutalized by apartheid, threatened by violence. Mandela described de Klerk as a man of integrity.
I got to know him as a very good listener, as a man with a legal mind, coming forth, generally speaking, with reasonable replies and reactions towards requests, towards suggestions. Solution-orientated.
He was perhaps much more trusting of Mr. de Klerk than a lot of the rest of us were. I think, whereas some of us saw de Klerk as having accepted the reality of negotiating with the genuine leaders, we didn't see him as a convert to democracy.
There seemed to be a special kind of alchemy operating between them. But once they got onto this whole thing of how to deal with the violence, and they had their differences, there was only one way their relationship was going to go, and it was down.
The violence had escalated dramatically since Mandela's release. The ANC believed the security forces had a hidden agenda to stall the move towards democracy by encouraging Zulu factions to go to war against their supporters. The bodies were piling up. Mandela asked to be taken to the scenes of the carnage.
It was a terrible sight. You know, to see women in young kids lying there, and the president was there as well. It was a difficult sight.
I will never forget his face. He was deeply shocked by the fact that people would do this to each other. I had the view that Madiba hadn't actually ever confronted the cold face of the violence during the 27 years of his incarceration.
He felt his release would be the end of a chapter of suffering. The organized killings were, in his mind, a negation of what he stood for.
Mandela's supporters were questioning the decision he had taken to call off the armed struggle.
I would stay in the crowd and just listen to what people were saying, and I would tell him. And people were singing a song. They were singing, "You're acting like a sheep and the people are dying." And he said, "Well, I have to show them that I'm not a sheep and I'm going to act very sternly."
Mandela called for an urgent meeting with the clerk in the middle of the night to say that you are the president, the violence is unacceptable. You, as president, can and must stop it.
His suspicion that somehow or another I was not doing enough or I don't have control, he would say to me, "But you are the president. You can stop the violence."
He felt that de Klerk was not coming clean, that de Klerk knew of this, was not admitting it, even in their confidential one-on-one meetings. And that is, to Mandela, just unacceptable at a personal level. He snapped with de Klerk. He doesn't like de Klerk, it's quite clear. He'll control it because he's a very controlled individual, and that's part of the prison legacy.
Then in 1993, the white right struck a blow that threatened all-out racial war. They assassinated Chris Hani, a hugely popular ANC leader.
There was his skull shattered. The Chris Hani episode was a near breaking point for everything that we had put together. But Chris died for peace.
I think you.
How shall we convince people?
People were in no mood for talk of peace. Mandela was hundreds of miles away at his house in the Transkei.
The phone rang, and I saw him talking on the phone. Yes, and his face went from that pleasant, pleased face to this stony, cold mask. There was no moment of grieving at all. That single moment was all of the political machinery and calculations that were going on in his head. What would this do for the nation? What would this do for the peace? What would this do for the negotiations?
Mandela flew immediately to Johannesburg. He had calculated that there was only one way to stop a bloodbath, to give his people proof that peace would lead them to freedom.
We used that moment very, very carefully to say to the enemy, to flatten them, "Now or never, you give us a date for elections on the death of Chris. There must be something."
This is a watershed moment for all of us. Our decisions and actions will determine whether we use our pain and our outrage to move forward to what is the only lasting solution for our country, an elected government of the people.
The election took place on the one-year anniversary of Hani's death. Mandela arrived for his presidential inauguration after a landslide victory. De Klerk would be his deputy president in a government of national unity.
The moment that has been long delayed
Right there, I was watching the ceremony. And there were all these ambiguities in my own mind. The head of the army, the head of the police, the very man that persecuted Winnie in Brantford, General van der Merwe, next to the president and Winnie nearby.
My heart went out to Winnie on that day. She was at the inauguration, and she was away from the central party. You imagine that this person must have waited her whole life for this moment, and it wasn't there for her. We discussed how we could possibly arrange at least that Mr. Mandela be part of the main party, but he wouldn't have it. It was his decision.
I, Nelson Odisatat Mandela, do hereby serve to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa and to devote myself to the well-being of the Republic and all its people.
Will you please raise your right hand and say, so help me God.
So help me God.
One great challenge remained. Mandela now led a racially mixed coalition government. But could he create a common nationhood among a people still deeply divided between black and white?
President Mandela was not a hands-on president at any time. Right from the beginning, he did not interfere in the day-to-day discussions and decisions which were taken. He acted more the role of a ceremonial president, a nation builder, trying to be a unifying factor.
Because you are older than I am.
Yes, I know.
One of his first acts was to invite Mrs. P.W. Botha and the widows of the other old apartheid leaders to lunch.
He called it to his house and he said, we must get these women together with some of our women. And I said, what are we going to say to them? My reaction was also a bit of horror. But I thought, well, it's reconciliation. I mean, you know, this is it.
There's a lady here who was the first that encouraged me in my new position. And that is Mrs. Gibbons.
It's not theater, it's not symbolic. It is this view that people have got to see this new South Africa as something in which they have a place, that we don't allow whatever gains we've got to be washed away.
Mandela was deliberately constructing himself as the embodiment of an ideal he wanted all South Africans to follow.
This is a practical way of forgetting the past and of building our country.
It's a nation-building strategy of reconciliation and so on. And he was prepared to go the whole hog, even when others would have felt awkward and embarrassed even.
Some of the things bamboozle you. You say to yourself, is it really happening? Is this Mrs. P.W. Botha sitting next to my president, talking as if things have always been normal? But he was there, the elegant Tembu gentleman, polite, humble, and down to earth.
Whose husbands have brought home to our country.
Think about Tim. Asinalo.
We as Tembus have no grudge against wrongdoers. If we cross each other's road today, tomorrow That's long past and forgotten. That is a good symbol of a good leader. Because if you are a leader, all people are your subjects. You have to listen to them. You have to pay homage to them when the occasion arises.
An occasion. The Rugby World Cup final in Johannesburg.
We're gonna rock. game played by the white oppressors, a game that was used by the governing party and the government of the time as highlighting how good we were as a country. I was walking out the change room, walking into this bright, harsh sunlight, 70,000 South African rugby fans chanting. I don't think I'll ever experience a moment like that again.
Mandela suddenly appeared in the captain's jersey, stunning the white crowd, standing by his team.
Nelson, Nelson, Nelson. We stood there and we didn't know what to say. The liberation struggle of our people was not about liberating blacks from bondage, but more so, it was about liberating white people from fear. And there it was. Fear melting away. Nelson, Nelson.
That's Ginger and Brooke.
New Zealand, the favourites, were expected to run away with the game.
On the inside to Pua, Sister Walter Little.
But in the dying minutes, with the game tied, South Africa made their move.
Stransky looks for the drop. Has he got it? Yes, he got it. That is it. The final whistle then. South Africa won the Rugby World Cup final.
The whole country went wild. He said later, it was the happiest day of his life.
That was a defining moment in the life of our country. It's not anything that you can contrive. It's unbelievable that when we won, the people could be dancing in Soweto. It had the effect of just turning around, I think, our country. It said, it is actually possible for us to become one nation. The icon of reconciliation and forgiveness, of holding together a country that everybody kept predicting. Oh, it didn't happen at the elections. It didn't go up in fringe in the elections. Give them 6 months, and this country will be down the tubes. It's 4 years later. And I do believe that without him, it would not have been possible to hold together those disparate parts that were flying all over the place. And that is, I think, his greatest legacy.
Mandela had promised he would leave office after one term. Back in the hills of Transkei, he has built a retirement home, an exact replica of the house he lived in at Victor Verster Prison. And now he has someone to share it with. He met the widow of the late president of Mozambique, Graça Machel, at a party.
You could see that Madiba was absolutely taken by Graça. He said to me that she's got such a beautiful smile. And I thought, wow, well, I think, you know, my boss is in love.
They were married on his 80th birthday.
While he's here, he is no longer regarded as a state president, but as a member of a royal family. It's compulsory.
Actually partakes in some form of advising the chiefs.
The young man who ran away from the responsibilities of his birth is now expected home.
He has a role to play.
Frontline's website. There's an analysis by his biographers of Mandela's life, character, and leadership. A collection of anecdotes and stories from those who've been with him throughout his life. Photos, letters, and excerpts from his autobiography. An archive of more than 2 dozen I'm going to end it.
Thank you.